The following is offered by Discerning Hearts, a 501c3 nonprofit Catholic apostolate dedicated to spiritual formation through the use of new media. To download this selection, or to browse hundreds of other programs, or to contribute to our mission with a charitable donation which is fully tax deductible, visit our website at discerninghearts.com.
Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute present The Formed Book Club, Catholic book lovers unpacking good books chapter by chapter. If you like us, please help us by subscribing and by reviewing us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you might listen. And don't forget to sign up for weekly updates and study questions at formedbookclub.ignatius.com.
Welcome to the Formed Book Club with your host, Joseph Pierce. We're trying to make him the host. With Father Fessio here, facilitator, and Vivian Dudreau as our lead intellectual interlocutor. We are going to continue our discussion of real philosophy for real people, tools for truthful living by my good friend and Jesuit Father McTagg. And we didn't finish chapter 3 last time. We're going to continue chapter 3. And chapter 3 is called Worldviews, What They Are, and Why They Matter. And then on page 76, he, as normal for him, he defines what he means there on the bottom paragraph. A worldview is how a person sees, understands, feels, and encounters that which in that worldview is true and good. I was thinking as I was preparing for this meeting we have here that this book is written by a professor of philosophy, and it's really based on a one-semester course, which is condensed and expressed in this book. And so if we're going to discuss it, I'm trying to figure out what is the best method. We already started it, but I mean, we can't try and explain everything, which would take a semester course to go through. So we're in the middle of the stream here, but how do you think we should proceed?
Well, I mean, I've made a point in my own leading of highlighting sparingly on the basis that if I didn't, either we would be reading anyway or we would never finish the book. So I'm sort of on average probably highlighting every 10th page or so. And I think that the key thing is just to be content with missing lots of good things out and hoping that we're an appetizer and that people want to buy the book and get the main course.
Vivian?
Perhaps Joseph can take us leapfrogging through what he's highlighted, and we can respond accordingly.
But I wouldn't want to miss out some of the observations that you and Father have highlighted. So I think it's just a question of being willing to just leapfrog over some of our own highlights. If we're getting behind schedule, just say, well, let's move on now to next chapter, regardless of the fact we've only got halfway through this one. I mean, if we're not expecting to be able to cover the whole thing comprehensively, then let's be content with the fact.
All right, but let's at least for each chapter, let's outline what the key structural elements are, and then we may have a few quotations we want to read in support of that, because this really is, as I'm rereading it, it's a wonderful opportunity to kind of reflect on one's whole life from a philosophical point of view. And he's so clear and also so concrete in his examples that I just think it's a great way to kind of maintain a kind of a philosophic or reflective life. For example, here in the world views, I mean, he's going to show that in terms of your total view of reality, there's only a certain number of worldviews that are possible. I mean, there's theism, that beyond this world, there's a God who takes gross interest in it. There's deism, which really became prominent in the Enlightenment, 17th, 18th century Europe. especially France and Germany, that, yes, God exists, but he's distant, and we know him as the first cause, and he created the universe, but we're on our own now. And then there's naturalism, which is the rejection of theism or deism. There is no God. Matter is all there is. And that tends to be associated with a scientistic, I won't say scientific, but a scientistic approach, which by its very method only is looking for material causes, for material events, but how that ineluctably leads to nihilism, which is a rejection of all meaning to experience in the world. But he shows how that is a, as I say, ineluctable and necessary consequence of naturalism. And therefore, to avoid that, there are two other worldviews. One, existentialism, which says, well, yeah, it's absurd, but I shake my fist at it and I'm going to resist it no matter what. And then what we're living in now, especially postmodernism, which basically says, we'll never know the truth anyway. It's all narrative. People in power create their narrative and impose it. And that we're going to deconstruct that and show you that all these narratives are really just expressions of power. The problem with that, of course, is that why are they constructing that narrative? I mean, what gives them the right to construct a narrative to create other narrative? Anyway, he goes into detail in this book and has charts and so on, but it really is a, I find it an illuminating overview of what's happened historically, because it's also true historically that the emphasis has been, well, polytheism, you know, prior to Christianity, prior to Judaism, then theism, especially monotheism with Judaism, and then after Christianity for centuries, that was sort of the dominant worldview till the Enlightenment, and then naturalism, well, deism in the Enlightenment, which then led to naturalism probably post-Enlightenment, we'll call it the modern period, and now postmodernism, we're really into nihilism. It's interesting how the emphasis historically has moved more and more away from God to nothing.
I just would like to quote the author as to what his purpose is in presenting this sketch of these worldviews. And that's on can be found on page 101, where he says, last paragraph, where he says, "My purpose is to provide the reader with the means of identifying the worldview, metaphysics, anthropology, and ethics embedded in any moral claim he may encounter. Once he is aware of these, he may evaluate, critique, clarify, reject, or improve upon what he has found. So able, he can begin to interpret the ambient culture which he finds himself. He can understand better the books he reads. He can converse more astutely with those who agree or disagree with him." And I would add another thing that this helps you to do, which, Father, you pointed to yourself in terms of this is an enriching experience for yourself to think about the way you think about things and why you do and how you've come to that. And, you know, this is a really helpful exercise.
I'm actually going to feel very guilty now as having preached one thing and then practiced another, making myself a hypocrite. Oh. You know, I actually want to go backwards from 101.
Okay.
To page the bottom of page 90, and I just talked about hypocrisy, but I think I love this. This is Father McTaig speaking rhetorically. How can anyone live as a nihilist? Does anyone live as a nihilist? As we move through the rest of this book, hope to show that no one can or does live as a nihilist. In other words, that, you know, we hear a lot and quite justly about the hypocrisy of Christians, you know, who preach one thing and practice another. You know, to try to be as Christ is not easy. But what we don't often hear about is the hypocrisy of nihilism. because the only logical position of a nihilist is to put a gun to his head and blow his brains out. As Chesterton in Man Alive memorably put it, right? The nihilistic philosopher there, the innocent Smith, pulls a gun on him. And all of a sudden, he begins to value life and to question his own nihilism. Now, I'm not suggesting that people should commit suicide if they're nihilistic, but the point I am suggesting that they are being hypocrites, because in enjoying life, however cynically, they are actually
affirming it.
They're denying their own first principles.
Well, so
that leads me to another point, Joseph, and that is that, you know, these schema of these worldviews are helpful. What's even more helpful to realize is that people keep trying on shoes until they find the thing that finally fits, right? And they can walk in. And, you know, if you're crippled by the shoes you're wearing, you're not going to wear them for long, thankfully. And so it's actually a hopeful thing to see the limits and the logical consequences of these things, because there's hope that people do actually come to realize, yeah, nihilism, who really is one, or who can be one for long? Or for that matter, even an existentialist, how long can you really be angry?
I think the danger is, to play devil's advocate, as I want to do, is that we can golemize ourselves. In other words, that we can, poisoned by a bad philosophy, then live a hedonistic lifestyle for so long that we actually uproot the real good sensibility in ourselves and become desensitized to such a degree that we are no longer fully human. And we've created the hell for ourselves, which is where we want to be now because we know nothing else. And I think that can happen before we die. And I think that's the danger of adopting this philosophy and the lifestyle, which is its correlative, is that we do endanger ourselves with golemization.
Since you brought us back to page 90, I want to just mentioned something just towards the top of the page, about a third of the way down, where he says, based on what we have seen so far, we may say that, here's the critical thing, the loss of the transcendent in naturalism leads to the loss of the personal, both human and divine. And I mentioned this book last session by Henri de Lubac, The Drama of Atheist Humanism. And he beautifully and quite readably outlines exactly how that happened. It's called The Drama of Atheist Humanism in the sense that in the 19th century, there was an intellectual attempt in Germany and France especially to develop and to appraise this idea of a humanism without God, that we've got rid of God, who's been alienating us because all the things we should strive for, we put in heaven, but they're actually on earth. And so you got Feuerbach to Marx with communism. You got Nietzsche with his nihilism and his Superman, Overman thing. And you got Kant with positive sociology in France. And they all led with this idea of exalting man to destroying man. And where was the great response? In the 19th century, according to Lubach, and he documents it, it was Dostoevsky. So anyway, that little sentence that I just quoted from Father McTagg really sums up a century-long or more so experiment, which has shown that it's a failure.
Father, I would also like to add that this can be turned around in a way and say that the loss of the personal, both human and divine, leads to naturalism and nihilism and all the rest. In other words, if you are operating on this mechanistic view of reality, chances are that personal dimension of God in your life was already lacking for whatever reason. So I see this as kind of, instead of a linear, it's a kind of a circle. You can lose the personal and then end up out here in the mechanistic. You can start with the mechanistic and end out here without the personal.
Well, and I think that is very pertinent to our present situation in the United States and in Western Europe especially, is that when you lose faith in God, what is left? Well, hope for the future, or hope for a human solution to things, a vaccine or a treaty or whatever, and it will not work.
Well, the problem is that they project that far enough in the future that they're talking about there's a sort of mystical golden age that we're progressing towards. And the danger of that, of course, you know, is that you're willing to kill countless number of people. You sacrifice them on this golden calf of golden age in the future. And that's the danger. That's what these people will do. I mean, that's why we have it systemic infanticide, right? Is that the doesn't matter how many people die, if what you're bringing about is a better future. And the better future is just a product of the imagination. It's a fantasy. It's never going to come true. But real people in real time are sacrificed for it. That's the problem.
We'll return to the Formed Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce in just a moment. Did you know that Discerning Hearts has a free app in which you can find all your favorite Discerning Hearts programming? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Deacon James Keating, Mike Aquilina, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and so many more are found on the Discerning Hearts free app. Did you also know that you can stream Discerning Hearts programming on numerous streaming platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and so many more? And did you know that Discerning Hearts also has the YouTube page? Be sure to check out all these different places where you can find Discerning Hearts. A prayer of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Take, Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will, all that I have and call my own. You have given all to me. To you, Lord, I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me. Amen.
Hello, my name is Deacon Omar Gutierrez, and I want to ask you to support Discerning Hearts in a special way. We, Chris McGregor, the board, and I all know that not everyone listening can help financially. We know we have listeners from all parts of the world, and we have made a commitment since the beginning to make the truths shared through Discerning Hearts totally free. So while you may not be able to contribute financially, what you can do is certainly pray, but also give us positive reviews on whatever platform you use to listen to us. If it's iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Spotify, however it is that you get these podcasts, or if you're on YouTube and you like our videos, please give us a good rating and write a review. The more good ratings and reviews we get, the higher our profile, and the more listeners will discover us, listeners who may have the means to contribute in the future. Please consider rating us and writing a positive review today.
We now return to the Formed Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce.
But if this life is all there is, why should I sacrifice my life for someone else's possible better future life?
I mean, I think, Father, the issue there is that we made in the image of God, and we do actually feel good by sacrificing ourselves for others. And so, you know, yeah, there's this golden age in the future, and I'm going to be a revolutionary today so that future generations will live in a just world, a perfect world, an Eden. So, yeah, they basically brought heaven down to earth, and some of them are willing to die for it. Altruistically, even though it's a load of nonsense.
All right, but I mean, I don't want to project my own selfishness on the whole human race, but if I'm asked to make sacrifices now, including my life, which is the end of everything for me, my absolute end, I go to nothing after that, is that a real motivation so that someone else can be happier in the future?
You need to read Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, because typically his analysis of the situation, you know who he is, right?
Eric Hoffer? Yes. Yeah.
you know, the ideologue willing to lay down his life or on one hand or kill on the other hand often doesn't have anything to live for. And so he becomes the useful idiots, the tools of ideological leaders. Those are the cannon fodder of these movements. These people who already figure, I don't have anything to lose. I don't have anything to live for. I don't have any purpose.
And well, the anarchist slogan in the Spanish Civil War of the nihilists in the anarchist movement was long live death, you know, and they were happy to die. Everything's pointless, useless, dead anyway. And they'll just get a sadistic pleasure in bringing down the church, bringing down everything they hate. And they're willing to die for their hatred.
Well, this is kind of a sidebar, maybe off the track a bit, but I remember when I first came to San Francisco about 50 years ago and was teaching. And as a matter of fact, I was trying to teach Balthazar to a freshman class. And I was so enthusiastic in my first year teaching and no one was getting it, you know. And I probably wasn't presenting it very well. I used to run down to the beach, 3.5 miles to the beach, and go into the, you go surf a bit. And there's an undertow there. And I remember going down, running down to the beach and going in there and feeling the undertow and thinking, you know something? If I just didn't resist for just a moment, it would drown me, be gone. I don't have to kill myself. I just have to relax a little bit and all these problems will go away. And I could understand at that moment, I understood suicide a little better, that you're driving a car, you know, you've had an argument with your wife or your husband, you just lost your job or whatever, or you've been caught for some crime, and you're driving your car along a crowded highway. Well, I'll just turn to the left a little bit, you know, and I'll get killed in a head-on accident. Now, I think there are a lot of suicides that are, we don't know as suicides, it looked as accidents, but people have given up. And related to that, what you just said, is I've talked to people who were gung-ho to be in the Marines or the Army. Why? Because they had no meaning. They didn't care if they got killed. They said, I mean, I'll do something that, you know, that'll get my name in the newspaper or something. If I win, if I die, so what? I don't want to live anyway. So there is kind of a death wish if you don't have faith, seems to me.
Yeah.
The fall, it's the fall from being. You know, it takes effort to stand up. And Tolstoy's, I know we're off topic now with suicide, but Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, she literally falls onto the railroad tracks. In other words, she ceases to have the motivation or energy to keep standing. So she literally falls in front of the train. You're right, Father. This, and you know, we all have moments in our life when we're vulnerable to this. We all have moments in our life where we are up against that frightening black.
Vivian, to lighten things up a bit, thanks for spoiling the end of the story for me.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's sorry. Are you reading it right now?
No, I'm joking. Oh. But
spoiler alert.
Giving the end of the novel. It was good.
Well, okay, this is related to it. I want to go back even further than page 90 to page 86 because Father McTague here is basing himself on this author, Sire, S-I-R-E, who talks about the three bridges from naturalism to nihilism. What is it? Why is it that people who lose their faith in God and become scientistically convinced that all there is material world, natural world, why does that lead to nihilism? Because at least with materialism, matter is there, right? And Sire says there's three bridges, page 86 at the bottom. The first bridge is necessity and chance. That is, if everything is necessity and chance, there's no human freedom, there's no will. What you decide is not a decision at all. It's basically determined by previous events. Well, what's the point? What is there? What meaning is there? There's none. The second bridge, page 88, the great cloud of unknowing. If you actually follow through philosophically, the consequence of materialism
there can be no thought. And by the way, the best expression of this that I've ever seen is in C.S. Lewis's Miracles, his book Miracles. But okay, so now you can't know anything for sure. And then on page 89 at the bottom, the third bridge is between is and ought. I mean, if you can't know anything, can't know what is, but you can't know what you ought to do or ought not to do either, there's no moral value to any decision you make. What is the point? And then there's a dissent. It's all useless. It's all meaningless. It's all nothing. And that, so I think it's interesting to me how Father McTague, quoting Sire, shows the psychological descent from naturalism to nihilism.
Yes. And do you think that was a good time to go into metaphysics then, his next chapter?
Because okay.
Because that's where he's talking about, so how do we come up with a way to think about what's real? 104, he gives a definition, metaphysics as an attempt to offer a systematic and coherent account for the real as such is, in our postmodern era, an embarrassing and laughable attempt to do the impossible. There can be no account of the real because nothing is real. I mean, Father, your statement leads to this empty metaphysics, but he's going to show us that we can, in fact, build a metaphysics for ourselves.
It's
not going to be just an arbitrary construction, but something that actually corresponds.
If I can just go back to the previous, the previous paragraph, because I love the way that Father McTague makes his points anecdotally. That's his real strength. It's the Irish Blarney in him. So he quotes here Hobbes. He says, Hobbes, if a man should talk to me of immaterial substances or of a free subject, I should not say he were in an error, but that his words were without meaning. That is to say, absurd. So these are the words of Hobbes. But then this is Father McTague's riposte. One might well ask Hobbes if he was speaking these words of his own free will, that is, as a free subject.
I know. Well, he makes that point repeatedly that these people who deny real metaphysics are denying it on the basis of real metaphysics.
Yes.
They're like someone on a tree on a limb, and you're sawing off the limb you're on, but you don't realize that limb is part of that tree.
Right.
I do want to have one quibble on the page 104, though. About a quarter of the way down, he says, from the Greek metaphysis, literally means beyond the physical. That's not quite right. Meta means either with or, in this case, after. And it turns out that in Aristotle's writings, if you get the collected works of Aristotle, you first read the physics, and then what he wrote after that was the meta. It's after physics. It also happens to be contentually, in terms of content, beyond physics, the transcendent. But the name actually only refers to the fact that in this series of books collected together, it was done afterwards. A small quibble.
Wow, that's an insight.
Yeah.
Very important. We can only communicate with each other with an accurate understanding of words. So I think that etymology is important, and that when a word is not used properly, we need to put it up. So, yeah.
Well, it also helps pedants to, exercise their pedantry to show their knowledge of Greek and history.
I'm looking forward to the great pedants revolt in the future. That's what I'm hoping for.
Okay. On page 107, there's another definition. It's pretty much the same one you read to us, Vivian.
Yes, I underlined this one too.
Okay, but just it's good to repeat it. I describe metaphysics here as an attempt at a systematic and comprehensive account of what is first and final, what is primordially and ultimately real, an explanation of what is and why the real is as it is. That's a very dense definition, but the wonderful thing is he gives you these dense definitions, and then he unfolds it, he unpacks it, he goes through it, and then he gives you kind of, I would say, almost homely examples sometimes of himself with his students.
Right. Well, I love that he takes apart immediately materialism as a false metaphysics and
yes.
on its own petard, right? So
yes.
109, the top, ironically, materialism, which maintains that only the physical is real, cannot account for physical bodies. It's a rather embarrassing failure for materialism.
Very good, yeah.
And I would want to say that we don't want to treat this too facilely, F-A-C-I-L-E-L-Y, that he gives, I think, very strong arguments against materialism in favor of theism. And I think they're reliable and sound. However, we know that, you know, there's been books and volumes written on these things. There's different opinions, and but I would say for someone who's developing his philosophic view, his worldview, this is a great start. But if you have any concerns or if you're skeptical, there's an immense amount of literature to explore more deeply these questions. But I think he's right, however. I mean, I do think it's one thing to simplify and falsify. It's another thing to simplify and clarify. And I think that he, my view, he simplifies and clarifies.
I also think, Father, that, you know, that at rock bottom, it's a question of faith. And I mean, actually, in an absolutely realistic, rational sense, because can you believe that nothing became something? And if you can believe that nothing became something, how do you believe that? You know, and the materialists get round it by saying, well, something has always been. Well, that's just fudging the issue. And that means, well, what actually is time? What is eternity? What is always been? I mean, in other words, that every effort to explain away metaphysics asks and begs other metaphysical questions. So, you know, I do think that he does a great job, but I don't think we need to read volumes and volumes. I think we do need to basically see someone who can be concise, anecdotal, in order to, you know, to make sense of what we should already know through common sense. And I think this book does it.
I won't argue with that. Not to say I won't argue at all, ever, with anything you say, but in that particular...
I was very intrigued by his little boxes here of the closed system on page 120 and then his open system on page 126. I have to say that I've had to do the Mortimer Adler approach to reading a book with this book, and that is I had to first just push through and read without necessarily understanding everything, and then go back and reread it, especially in the more difficult sections. And this was one of those sections I had to read more than once to grasp what he's doing with this closed system and open system. It reminded me a little bit of C.S. Lewis's Miracles, but this was not just, oh, just read it through and you're going to get it. I had to really think about what he was saying. And once I did that, the rewards were worth it, because then when I did understand it, it's like a flower opening, you know, and letting off its fragrance, you know?
Yes, and I think the key point here is that in his discussion of the real, he very clearly distinguishes between two elements. One, the constituents of the real, and time.
Yeah.
You know, because, so it's basically space and time. I mean, everything we experience in space and time. And so he's talking about, in a certain sense, space, what is everything made of? And then time, how is it connected? And what is the psychological experience we have of before and after? And he distinguishes between now and present. It's an interesting thing. Well, you know, if you ask someone, out of the blue, well, give me, how would you distinguish these two things? Most people would just say, well, I don't know, the same thing to me. But he talks about how now is just the isolated instant, you know, like a frame of a picture in a movie, and the present, which is the moment we're in now, in the context of its past and of its future.
Yeah, I heard it, that passage. I can't remember what page it's on, but I actually, without wanting to, I mean, it was very, there was a very dexterous gambit there by Vivian to move us on 30 pages in one leap.
Yeah, so. Good. Well, I mean, it's on page, it's on page 119. He says,
yeah, but I actually wanted to discuss, and maybe we shouldn't now because we've been going for half an hour plus already. But on page 113, this famous passage from St. Augustine about time, present, future.
Yes,
as a launching pad for this discussion of time. Maybe that could be where we begin next week as a suggestion.
Let's do that. I agree. So, well, exactly where will we start though? On page
113, his quote from St. Augustine on 113.
Okay. Let's do that. And we'll be back next week. This is it's a pretty comprehensive book. I mean, metaphysics, what is? Anthropology, what are we? And ethics, how should we act? I mean, this is a basic, I would say, tools for truthful living. It's a great toolbox. All right. Thanks, Joseph. Thanks, Vivian. And thanks to our audience here. We hope to see you next week. God bless you for joining the Formed Book Club.
If you enjoyed this discussion, please help spread the word about the Formed Book Club by subscribing to the podcast and writing a review. You can sign up for weekly updates at formedbookclub.ignatius.com.